It's Thursday, October 12th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Biden administration has agreed to freeze the $6 billion Iran had gained access to as part of the prisoner swap deal between the administration and Tehran. This was, as you'll recall from our discussion on Tuesday, a prominent talking point of critics of the Biden administration, and in contrast to cavils about Biden putting a lid on press availability or having a barbecue, it was a somewhat legitimate critique, or legitimate enough for the administration to take the short-term hit of appearing to concede the point of the critics. But another way to look at this is, well, I was speaking to a former Senate staffer, and he asked me if I thought the U.S. or Israel, with the U.S.'s approval, might expand the current fight into Iran. And I said, well, I don't know. I don't have a direct line to the Pentagon, and I can only be quoted as a source unfamiliar with Bibi Netanyahu's thinking. But it would be pretty strange, inconsistent, and hard to defend if on the one hand, the U.S. were bombing Iran, and on the other hand, the U.S. were paying Iran. Harder to defend than even the Natanz nuclear facility. Like a slice of the Zagros Mountains, that is a deep cut. Or the decision to freeze the funds could be, as my guest contends, simply prudent and not worth the hassle of trying to justify the funds over and over again. In any case, it is actually good that the administration showed nimbleness. They know they will be pilloried as a weak or mealy-mouthed group of actors. Who cares? They're now in a better position than they were yesterday. And Iran is, I think, in a bit worse of a position. Also, the prisoners have been exchanged. Declare victory, go home, and maybe someday down the road, let the Qataris move around some funds in a jointly owned account co-signed by an Ayatollah. On the show today, the seeming achievements in the Dallas Public Schools advanced math classes. But first, what is to come in the conflict between Israel and Hamas? We talk next to Stephen Simon, who served on the National Security Staff as Senior Director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs from 2011 to 2012. He is a former State Department official, and he has worked for RAND and is now with the Quincy Institute. Stephen Simon up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And joining me now is Stephen Simon. He's an expert on Middle East matters. He served in both the Obama and Clinton administration. He is now with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Remember a few months ago, he was on to talk about his new book, The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East. Mr. Simon, welcome back to The Gist.
Well, thank you for having me again. Appreciate it.
So Israel is certainly pursuing a ground war in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to destroy Hamas. Quote, every Hamas member is a dead man. Good quote. But I think literally speaking, impossible. The leaders aren't even in Gaza. So the first question is, how far can Israel go in achieving that aim?
Well, I think they can actually go pretty far. It depends on the cost they're willing to pay to do that. But they have the capacity to do it. It requires going in on the ground with a major incursion and rooting people out of their hiding places as they discover them via intelligence means. So, yes, it's in the realm of possibility. Do they really want to go that far? Open question.
Yeah. And will that serve the ultimate strategic aim, which is not just upsetting and destroying this organization, but truly setting back the cause of inflicting damage and death on the Israeli civilian population?
Well, I think it's hard to... It's so awful. I mean, I think it's hard actually to identify a strategic objective. I mean, a strategic objective would entail dealing once and for all with this difficult situation that has evolved over the course of decades, namely the unresolved competition of Israelis and Palestinians for land, you know, between the Jordan River and Israel and the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. That would be a strategic objective. Okay, so to give you an example, because I just think it's worth doing, so I'm going to take 10 seconds.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.
The Arabs and Israelis fought a tremendous war in 1973. It was a really bloody, and it killed at least twice as many Israelis as the current conflict has killed. But it was swiftly turned into a diplomatic process that ultimately led to a peace agreement, a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, okay? And Egypt was Israel's main military challenger on the ground. Okay, that was a strategic objective. You get a peace treaty with your enemy, you turn them into a friend, or at least a non-belligerent, and then you've dealt with a major threat to your security for the foreseeable future. Right now, we're not really looking at the establishment of a strategic objective to mm-hmm. which the Israelis and maybe the Arabs are striving.
Right.
That's not there.
Well, I don't know if it's easier. It certainly seemed impossible to achieve that objective that was achieved, of course, at a great cost, the assassinations of the signatories of the Camp David Accords. But in that case, you're at least dealing with nation states. This is different. Yes, I know, we both know that Hamas years ago was elected as the representative of Gaza, and then elections stopped happening. Polls, and they haven't been done in a while, indicate that they're extremely unpopular among Gazans. I don't know if their popularity will have gone up and down. I mean, is a strategic objective even possible when you're dealing with this quasi-terrorist, quasi-nationalist force?
That's a fair question. And no, I would say that not right now. That's pretty clear. And in fact, you know, it's been remarked on quite frequently in recent days in Israel that, and actually conceded by the right-wing leadership in Israel, that Hamas has always been a great partner for the Israelis. Because the Israelis and Hamas share, I guess you could say, a strategic objective in the sense that each one seeks the elimination of the other.
They're pretty clear on that, right?
Yeah, and the thing is as long as Hamas held that position, it essentially justified Israeli, you know, the Israeli agenda. Vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So it was really convenient. In fact, one of the leaders of the right-wing opposition said, you know, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, it's a burden. Hamas, an asset. Mm-hmm. He said that.
Yeah.
You know, so there's been a perverse convergence of interests, which periodically collapses. And at least, you know, in the years since 2005, when Israeli troops and settlers and so forth left Gaza, leaving it essentially to Hamas, which itself was originally supported by Israel as an alternative to the West Bank Palestinian leadership.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's collapsed, and the Israelis are under a lot of pressure now, internal pressure, to deal with this situation in some decisive way. And they have, I think, a lot of support on that score in the United States. I mean, even Barack Obama tweeted the other day that he favored the quote-unquote dismantling of Hamas. Okay, so that's Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So you can imagine where the Israeli leadership is, and there's probably some sympathy for this objective within the Biden administration. But again, you know, it comes down to the cost. I mean, there's a sweet spot on yes. on the timeline here that the United States, you know, frequently looks to occupy,
mm-hmm.
and that sweet spot. It's on a timeline, and it's, you know, up to that sweet spot, the United States will provide diplomatic cover for the Israelis to do what it is they think they need to do mm-hmm. In Gaza, operationally, you know, on the ground or from the air or what have you. But beyond that sweet spot, it becomes too costly diplomatically for the United States and really for Israel to continue these operations, which tend to be highly destructive because it's urban terrain.
Right.
So the casualties are really going to be terrible, as we've already seen. So
right. So you say timeline. Is the constraint temporal, or is it more in terms of the images and realities coming out into the world of what the costs are?
Well, I think, you know, they're both sides of the same coin, because the longer this goes on, the more destructive it is. And, you know, people would be looking really at three factors. Overall, the civilian toll, which will climb rapidly, and then in a way, subsets of that larger consideration are infrastructural damage, which is going to be really bad. And it's not just the buildings that are destroyed, but it's everything underneath the street.
Mm-hmm.
So water pipes, sewage pipes, electronic, you know, electric transmission cables, all that sort of stuff just gets torn up. And that in turn relates to this third consideration, which is public health. So you'll wind up quickly, relatively quickly, with a public health catastrophe in Gaza.
Right.
Because nobody will have access to clean water. There'll be sewage floating in the streets. You know, typhoid will become a problem. And some of these, you know, illnesses that, you know, are connected to failed sanitation systems.
Yeah, I was thinking about that specifically. I understand it's war, and I understand the argument from a military standpoint of denying energy to the area. Food is a little, I suppose, with food shipments, arms could be shipped in. That's a little more questionable. But water, to me, is there a real military advantage beyond, I suppose, if the combatants have no water, along with all 2 million other citizens, there's something to that. But have you thought specifically about the water component to the embargo?
Well, you know, I'm not a liar, but you know, the rules of war are kind of flexible on this point, because one of the there are a number of considerations that a lawyer would point to. One of them would be proportionality, of course, but there is another which they call necessity, military necessity. And I think what the Israelis would argue is that they're on solid ground in terms of the rules of law, because you cannot conduct a campaign in Gaza against Hamas without civilian casualties without killing non-combatants. And that's military necessity, they would say. And if we could do it some other way, we would do it some other way. But the fact is we can't. You got 2 million people crammed into a space, you know, just double the size of Washington, D.C. It's pretty small. It's immensely densely populated. And if you've seen the aerial footage of Gaza, you can see every inch of it is built up.
Yeah.
So there's no way to carry out strikes without killing civilians. So that's what they would say. You know, other countries and other legal interpretations of the rules of war might take issue with Israel's position on this, but the Israelis will say, you know, we haven't transgressed.
Yeah. What are the costs? What are the benefits? Something to think about. But overall, the rules of engagement are going to be much less restrained than they were in the past. But the question is, how far is too far in terms of the Israelis' own self-interest? And then there's another question, which is, what should be the U.S. role in getting them to realize that? But let's go in order. You know, there is a point that is too far in terms of the Israelis' own self-interest in terms of the cost that they are imposing on the Gazans. Do you think they recognize this?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're wondering why they haven't gone in on the ground yet, there's your answer. It's not clear. And there's an additional factor you didn't mention, but I'm sure it's on your mind, and that's the hostages.
Yes.
You know, there are at least 150 hostages in Gaza. The Hamas has threatened to start killing them if the Israelis go in on the ground. Maybe a dozen of those hostages are U.S. citizens and therefore a concern to the Biden administration, and undoubtedly accounted for in talking points that that Secretary of State Tony Blinken is using with Netanyahu today. So the Israelis have to first consider, okay, what happens to these hostages? And there's now underway already negotiations over the fate of the hostages. The Germans are involved. The Qataris are involved. There's a process going on. Well, who knows, you know, how successful it'll be or how many hostages will be released and in turn for what actions by Israel, don't know, but there's a process. So the Israelis have to be considering that. And they need to be considering escalation and a broadening of the conflict if they do go in, and they're not really sure what to do. Hezbollah is up there in Lebanon. The Hezbollahis, the leader of Hezbollah, you know, has said, we really don't want to get involved in this. You know, this is just not where we want to go. But they may not feel as though they have a choice after a point if the Israelis are operating on the ground in Gaza in a highly destructive way, you know, where the tempo of the violence is really bad.
Right.
And they need to consider escalation on the West Bank. You know, Jerusalem, as the Israelis, you know, have wanted it to be, is a unified city. And it's a unified city that's got a lot of Palestinians and Palestinian Arabs. And you have mixed towns, you know, in Israel. That is to say, Israeli citizens, Israeli, you know, identity card holders and all that.
Yeah.
But they're not unaffected by what's going on in Gaza. And there has been serious violence in those towns, not for the past couple of years, but it was bad, you know, in recent memory. So the Israelis, they have got to be thinking about all of this, as well as their relations with Western states, whose backing they now enjoy.
Right. So how far, let us say the EU, so how this would go is the EU might be first to say too far, and then at some point the US might say too far. Will that stop them? You know, this is I take them at their word. This is the worst calamity they've faced, their 9/11, however you want to phrase it. Can they really be stopped by falling out of the good graces of their patrons?
Well, You know, the answer to that, Mike, is we'll see. Some Israelis who aren't positions of responsibility draw some lessons from the 2006 war that Israel fought in Lebanon against Hezbollah. It's a war that Israel is generally regarded as, well, not having won, but one in which they paid a high price, in which the Israeli government at that that stage paid a high price as well politically. And that lesson is that they could have won if the United States and other countries hadn't weighed in and prevented them from completing the work that they were doing in Lebanon, mostly in terms of destroying civilian infrastructure as a way of pressuring the Lebanese to get a grip on Hezbollah. So they're there, and you know, these individuals are there, and they will probably be counseling the need to go ahead and just do this, because at the end of the day, the gains will outweigh the costs. In other words, if they get rid of Hamas, then Hamas has got rid of. If they alienate Europeans in the United States, well, you know, give it a few years and things will be okay again.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it kind of makes sense just to do it. But now with this new government, or at least this emergency government.
This unity government, yeah. Very, a few cabinet members on the same page, correct.
Yeah. So, well, and the, you know, Netanyahu and who's always been cautious, actually, about the use of force himself. The more tough-minded members of the war cabinet have to take into account where the former opposition, the White-Blue Party, and former General Benny Gantz, are willing to tolerate.
Mm-hmm. Take me inside Hezbollah's mindset as you understand them. Do they say, let us attack now because Israel is weak? Or do they say, Israel is livid, the gloves are off, we best bide our time, the costs may be too much, we'll still have our hundreds of thousands of rockets to use at a later date? What are they thinking?
Yeah, so I think in the first instance, they're looking at their own situation within the framework of Lebanese politics.
And they're not popular there.
No, and Lebanon is rapidly devolving as a state. I mean, it doesn't even have an economy, really, except for a barter economy. It's shocking and dismaying what's happened in that country. And the population are understandably furious with the government that allowed this disaster, economic disaster, to unfold in Lebanon. And Hezbollah is blamed just as much as any of the other leading political parties. And Hezbollah is a more prominent factor in Lebanese politics than many of these other actors. And that just makes them more of a target for public rage.
Yeah.
So do they want to start a war with Israel now that will wreck what's left of Lebanon? I think not.
And not out of kindness, right? Not out of any concern for Lebanon or the Lebanese, for their own, just to have their own staging ground, for instance.
Yeah, I think, you know, depending upon who you spoke to, you'd get, you know, different answers to that. But I think, you know, they're looking right now at an American aircraft carrier, a carrier strike group that's basically, you know, parked next door to Hezbollah headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the USS Ford has an embarked wing. It's like 90 airplanes. That's more than the size of a lot of nation's air forces. They can, you know, their sortie rate, I mean, since they're right there, it's not like they're flying 500 miles to drop bombs and then have to fly 500 miles back. Okay, they're over the target in 5 minutes. They deliver their payloads. They're back on the carrier deck in another 5 minutes, and they're reloaded, and then they're back out again.
How many did you say they have? 90. Okay, yes, that's what I thought. Yes, 90. But by comparison, the Lebanon entire Air Force, I just looked it up, is 68 active aircraft.
Yeah, and, you know, most of them are Hangar Queens.
That's right. Crop dusters, yeah.
So, so they're looking at that. And they're looking at an Israeli call-up of 300,000 soldiers. Okay? Now, they might think, and certainly the Iranians like to think, that, you know, especially looking at the state of Israeli politics over the past year, they might be thinking, the Israelis, that country is coming apart at the seams, you know? They're no longer what they were, and look at how they failed to deal with this Hamas invasion in the south. They're on the downslide. Well, a country on the downslide doesn't mobilize 300,000 reservists in less than 36 hours.
Right. So the narrative and why Hamas is making these videos and holding up the beheaded remains of their victims is to give the impression that Israel is weak. Well, that might be inspirational to other Hamas fighters, but the facts and the mobilization and what we've seen with their military personnel belie those Hamas assertions, you're saying.
Well, yeah. And when Hamas pleaded with Hezbollah at the outset of this conflict to join in, Hassan Nasrallah, who is the leader of Lebanese Hezbollah, sent out a very nice message wishing Hamas the best of luck. And, we'll see you on the other side.
So the last question and the last area I want to ask about is the announcement today that the the $6 billion in funds for the prisoner exchange have been frozen or withdrawn. Now, I know that the Biden administration was saying that all of these funds would go to humanitarian purposes. And I know that the Qataris were supposed to administer those funds. But what do you think that freezing these funds, making these funds unavailable, signals from the Biden administration?
It signals that they don't want this issue to suck the air out of the room in Washington.
Okay.
That's what it signals.
Taking it off the table as a talking point, even if they take the one-day hit of, fine, you were right, let's not even debate it. Got it.
It was a sensible thing to do, I thought, politically.
By the way, knowing what you know about how these things are orchestrated, what did you think of the argument that, yes, the funds are earmarked for humanitarian purposes, but ultimately funds are fungible?
Yes, ultimately funds are fungible. But for the kinds of things that Iran is doing, how much money does it really need?
Yeah, these things didn't take a huge amount of expenditure. It just took cunning and the Israelis not paying close enough attention, I would say.
Yeah, well, both Israel, and it's important to say this, both Israeli and American officials have said there is no evidence of Iranian involvement in the Hamas assault on Israel. And the Iranian leader has said, hey, it's really a great thing. We're glad Hamas did this, but we didn't have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, maybe he's saying that to avoid attack, but I think this is true. And in part, you know, there's people believe this, that is, people believe the contention that Iran was involved, in part because they're really looking to egg the administration on to hostilities with Iran. So anything that serves that purpose will be useful. And there's also this view, which ironically one heard, in the wake of 9/11, that, oh, man, this was such a sophisticated attack. Arabs couldn't do it. Now, those nudniks in Gaza couldn't pull this off.
Only the wily Persians.
Precisely. You put it better than I could have. Yes, precisely. The wily Persians. Mm-hmm. You pulled it off, and I really disregard that.
Well, I appreciate your insight and your time. Stephen Simon served as the National Security Council Senior Director for the Middle East and North Africa during the Obama administration, served during the Clinton administration, author of The Rise and Fall of American Ambition in the Middle East, and he's now with the Quincy Institute. Thank you again so much.
Thanks very much, Mike.
And now the spiel. Headline, NBC News. Latino, Black, and Roman in advanced math shot up after states made this change. Should it be a model? The clear implication is yes. If you consider the subhead and the text, subhead, Latino and Black students in advanced math courses grew when Texas districts stopped relying on recommendations and automatically enrolled qualified students. The information, to flesh it out a little bit more, is, quote, before the pandemic, Black and Hispanic students in Texas were routinely left out of advanced classes. And then the article by Suzanne Gamboa, national correspondent for NBC Latino and NBCNews.com, then she spells out what happened. Using test results from 2014 to 2015, researchers studied students whose math scores were in the top quintile, 90% to 100%, to see if they had taken Algebra 1, according to this director of the survey. And they found out that even with the same scores, it was much more likely that white and Asian students would be in advanced classes as opposed to their Black and Hispanic classmates. Now, I have to say that something jumped out about that assertion. It's that the top quintile is not 90 to 100%. That would be the top decile. So I don't know if the error is one of math or one of language, certainly one of editing. But it did make me question the overall veracity of what was being asserted. NBC, because it was NBC, was playing the national politics angle to this story. The lead graph positions what was going on in the context of culture war education issues. It begins in a state that has passed anti-diversity laws and tried to squelch instruction on systemic racism. A new law could open doors for Latino and Black children long shut out of advanced math courses. And then, moving on from Texas, the article ends with the lines, Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas and Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, both Democrats, are planning to introduce legislation to set up a competitive grant program for schools and districts to help them increase enrollment and performance of underrepresented students in advanced courses. Enrollment and performance. Remember that. So from what I could glean was going on, high-achieving Black and Hispanic students, they weren't being put in the classes that matched their abilities. And it's because parents had to opt in. So Texas changed the law. They identified high scores. They just looked at the scores and automatically enrolled them in these high-achieving classes, these advanced classes. So instead, they could opt out, I suppose, if they wanted to. I know a little bit about human psychology. I've read and interviewed the authors of Nudge. This seemed to be, I don't know, a no downsides, if not solution, then experiment. The entire NBC story was a rewrite of a Dallas Morning News story, so I checked that one out. The story is about, quote, an effort to remove barriers that can stand between bright students and rigorous courses. And here are the facts, as reported in the Dallas Morning News. In 2018, prior to the new policy, 17% of Black students in sixth grade and a third of Hispanic students were in honors math, half of white students. Now, 43% of Black students are in honors math. Nearly 6 in 10 Hispanic students are. The percentage of white sixth graders in honors math has also gone up to roughly 82%. I checked out the demographics of the Dallas Independent School District. That's what those statistics were talking about. It's 70% Hispanic, 21.4% Black, and 6% white. Utilizing my very high decile status as a math guy, I calculated that most of the eighth graders in the Dallas Independent School District are now in advanced math. Well, wonderful. It would certainly be a shame if these advanced students were denied that status. The article talks about remedying the wrong of past discrimination and disparate impacts and ends with this hopeful note. The payoff may be years away when current Dallas students win high-paying jobs in STEM fields. But one thing never gets answered. Is it working? Sure, it's working if you define working as defining the majority of eighth graders as advanced, but has the, quote, more rigorous instruction paid off? I won't make you wait. The answer is no. In three words, not even close. Though the article doesn't offer the relevant statistics to evaluate the program, they're out there. I looked up the National Assessment of Education Progress, often called the nation's report card. In fact, that is the exact phrase prominently on their website, quote, often called the nation's report card. These Dallas eighth graders, more often than not in advanced classes, are scoring 260. Okay, that's meaningless until you know that the level defined as basic is 262. It's not fair to compare the results in large urban school districts like Dallas to dissimilar districts, so they helpfully have the comparison to other large urban school districts, and Dallas, with its mostly advanced eighth graders, is 6 points below the average of other large school districts. Only 47% of Dallas students in eighth grade are at the basic achievement level, 12% are at or above the proficient level, and those deemed advanced nationally to match the advanced label of their math classes, it's 2% in Dallas. Before this change, but also before the pandemic, it was 4%. So those statistics are from the nation's report card in 2022. I found more recent one statistics just from the state in 2023. It uses the Texas state metric of at grade level, and it says that in Dallas, eighth graders, 48% met grade level in reading, and 40% met grade level in math. But it was only 36% in math last year. So that is an improvement. Another positive sign is that the gap between Dallas and other large districts in math on the nation's report card narrowed in 2022 as compared to 2019, 2019 being the year of the pandemic, but perhaps a reason that Dallas schools didn't suffer as much is that they weren't shut down for as long as Chicago, New York, LA, some other large school districts. So I would say maybe there's some benefit to telling kids you're advanced and telling more kids of different races, you're all advanced. But other than changing the demographics of the classes labeled advanced, it seems to be having no effect on actual advancement in Dallas. You wouldn't know this from the coverage. You would think the opposite. And of course, it won't occur to most people to know otherwise because they're not in the top decile of quality podcast information. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is CLFAO of Peachfish Productions. See how that rolls off the tongue and squishes under the foot? The Gist is presented along with our partners at Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. Would you like to advertise on The Gist and reach our highly educated about Dallas 8th grade math audience? Go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-gee-puru-doo-puru, and thanks for listening.